The following is intended only for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another captivating episode of the Anthology of Horror podcast. I'm your host and narrator, Spring-Heeled Jack, and today we're diving into a subject that's both fascinating and spine-tingling. We'll be delving into the world of the supernatural and discussing a phenomenon that has intrigued generations, and that is the belief that babies and young children have a unique ability to see ghosts, spirits, and sense things that remain hidden from others. As we explore this eerie topic, you'll be taken on a journey through the mysterious and the uncanny, examining tales and accounts that will leave you pondering the supernatural world in a new light. Join us as we unravel the mysteries of what lies beyond the veil of the living and the extraordinary perception of the very young. Welcome to the Anthology of Horror podcast. A leading theory among parapsychologists suggests that humans are born with their, quote, third eyes wide open. But most of us lose our ability to see spirits as we age. Why do we lose this keen sixth sense? For one simple reason, because we're taught not to see. In our American culture, few adults accept the idea that spirits are around us and that children can see them. Kids know when adults doubt them. They can sense their parents' discomfort, even when the adults don't deliberately shame or ridicule them. Kids want to please their parents, so little by little, their third eyes droop until they are so tightly shut they can no longer see beyond this world. In the following story, a group of young cousins witnessed something they were told was impossible. Decades have passed since the frightening episode, and the children who experienced it are now middle-aged and old and sad. But they remember it clearly. And when they compare notes, they realize they did not imagine the madman they encountered in their grandparents' attic. When most people remember time spent at their grandparents' house, their memories are quite pleasant. Some folks think of fresh-baked cookies, and others smile as they reminisce about grandma's prize-winning tomatoes or the wonderful stories their grandpa told. I can tell you for sure, my grandfather told some whoppers. So good that I'm not going to say them on the air, but they were doozies. And almost everyone remembers feeling safe. When Marilyn Covarrubias thinks of her grandparents' house, however, she remembers the scariest moment of her life. Marilyn was barely school age in 1950, when she and an assortment of siblings and cousins were often dropped off for long stays with her grandparents in their rented home in Los Angeles, California. It was an old house, she recalled, and it was right across the street from Hazard Park. The 25-acre park with rolling green hills and countless trees to climb, it was named for Henry Hazard, one of L.A.'s first mayors. The park was enticing to children who often sneaked across the road to play there when the adults left them on their own. "We were left alone a lot," she confided. It was a little spooky considering that the house made more than its share of odd noises. While old houses often tend to creak and groan as the weather changes, the sounds that Marilyn and her cousins heard could not be explained. "We heard a woman and a baby crying," she said, and described the eerie phantom sobs that emanated from an empty room. "One day, my grandma pulled a piece of cardboard off of a hole in the wall and found old clothes inside of it." Marilyn watched as her grandmother reached into the wall and extracted old garments, clothing that had once belonged to a woman and baby. Was it hidden in the wall for a sinister reason? Did it have something to do with the ghostly sobbing? Perhaps it was simply insulation. In bygone days, used clothing was sometimes recycled as home insulation. The house was made of heavy wood with plank floors, like many of the homes built in the 19th century, and it had probably seen many families come and go. Today, Marilyn can't help but wonder if one of those families left something more than clothing behind. But as a child, she didn't realize anything was off. She enjoyed playing with her gang of cousins in the third-floor attic, an area designed for the grandchildren. My grandparents kept two big beds up there, and they pushed them together in the middle of the room. The children loved to jump on the beds and race around the attic. One evening, when Marilyn was six, the kids again found themselves alone. It was Grandma's bingo night, she remembered. There were six of us playing in the attic. The group ranged in age from her little sister Karen, who was just a year old, to her cousin Reuben, who was eight. Donnie, Reuben, Marion, Marilyn, Tony, and Karen were all happily playing when they heard the familiar sound of heavy footsteps pounding up the stairs. My grandpa was a big man, with size 14 shoes, said Marilyn. He always made a lot of noise when he came up the stairs. The kids were up past their bedtime, so they rushed to get into bed, pulling the covers up to their chins as they listened to their grandpa's approaching steps. We were all giggling and trying to pretend that we were asleep. But when the door flew open, it was not Grandpa. A stranger stood in the doorway. The man looked as if he had been caught in a downpour. He was so wet that his hair was matted to his forehead, said Marilyn. He wore a plaid shirt like a lumberjack, and his eyes were bloodshot. They were so bloodshot that they were almost completely red. As he stood there, the stranger made a sound that is hard for Marilyn to describe, yet impossible for her to forget. It was as if he were laughing and crying at the same time. The children were dumbstruck by the image of the wild man with the maniacal cry. They watched in horror as he suddenly bolted towards them. When he reached the beds, he did not stop. He ran right through the beds. We could feel him, said Marilyn, describing the sensation as a rush of cold wind passed through him. The man dove for the window, and as he broke through the glass, they heard it shattering around them. And then, the only sound was the steady patter of rain. Was the crazy man outside, broken and dead on the ground, far below the attic window? The kids were too scared to get out of bed and look. They huddled beneath the blankets, waiting for what seemed like hours. Then we heard footsteps on the stairs again. The children were petrified and barely able to breathe as heavy feet thundered up the stairs towards them. And again, the door flew open. This time it was their grandpa. We jumped out of bed and ran to him. We were all crying. Their grandfather listened as they clung to him and told their wild story. It was just your imagination, he said, consoling them as he patted their heads. He led them to the window. See, he said patiently, the glass isn't broken and it's not raining. It was true. The windows were indeed intact and the night was dry. Grandpa must be right, 6-year-old Marilyn decided. There was no man, no shattered glass, nobody had jumped through the window. They had imagined the whole thing. Decades later, she had not forgotten the crazed man who dove through the attic window. She was reminiscing with her cousin Tony at a family gathering when he mentioned the ghost in the attic. She gasped. I thought I imagined that. Oh no, he assured her, it really happened. Tony recalled the scene exactly as she had, and he told her that he and Reuben had discussed the bizarre occurrence many times over the years. Marilyn had accepted her grandfather's explanation without question when she was a child. Now she realized that his reasoning was wrong. It wasn't possible that all of the kids would imagine the same thing. She tried to make sense of what had happened and asked her mother if she'd ever noticed anything odd about that house. Her mother confided that she, too, had seen something peculiar there. On one memorable afternoon, she had been napping on the couch in the living room when she awoke to see a woman with a dog walking across the room. My mother told me that the dog stopped and licked her hand, said Marilyn. As the woman strolled by, the canine followed, and then suddenly they both vanished. Who were the ghosts? Had they lived and died in the house? Had the clothing found in the wall belonged to the former residents who met tragic ends there? And what about the madman in the attic? Had he killed himself by leaping through the window? If so, why did he do it? Had something awful happened to him, or had he done something so bad to someone else that it drove him to suicide from guilt? Despite my digging, I have yet to find a historical account of a man leaping through the window in the grandparents' attic. I found nothing to explain the paranormal activity in the spooky old house. While the mystery may never be solved, I'm continuing to research. The source of the haunting in the next case, however, has been determined, just like the children who witnessed the madman in the attic. The little boy in this story saw a ghost at his grandparents' house. He, too, was dismissed when they chalked the sightings up to a child's imagination. In this case, however, the boy was finally believed when his grandparents learned the shocking truth. When the couple moved into their home in Modesto, California, they did not inquire about its history. They knew only that the cute, ranch-style house in the quiet neighborhood seemed perfect for them. After they moved in, their little grandson, who often stayed with them, made a new, imaginary friend that he called Debbie. As the adults relaxed and enjoyed their dream home, the toddler played with his invisible buddy. The grown-ups just laughed and shook their heads. It did not occur to them that Debbie was anything other than a figment of the child's imagination, and they had no idea that their dream house had turned into a nightmare house for someone else. Deborah Ann Whitlock was a vivacious woman who loved life. At 32, the Modesto wife and mother worked for Sears and was slated to be their youngest female store manager. She was hardworking and dedicated to her job, but most of all, she was devoted to her 3-year-old daughter, CJ. It was the love for her daughter that allowed her to endure the worst day that any human being can without uttering a scream. On March 25, 1988, Debbie was brutally attacked in her own bed as her toddler slept in the next room. "She was a hero," said Debbie's mother, Yox McDonald. If she had screamed, CJ would have woken up. She kept quiet to save her daughter's life. Scott Avery Fizzle was a teenage meth addict in the spring of 1988. He prowled the Whitlock's neighborhood in camouflage clothing, looking for things to steal to fund his habit. He carried a burglary kit that included gloves and a Halloween mask as he crept through backyards searching for unlocked doors and windows. It was close to midnight that Thursday when he discovered the Whitlock's sliding glass door unlocked. He slipped into their home and found Debbie's purse in the kitchen. He took the purse containing $7 and left. So why did he return? Why didn't he just take the money and move on? Tragically, he had something more sinister than theft in mind. He returned to the house, went to Debbie's room, and touched her as she slept. When she awoke in a panic, he killed and then sexually assaulted her. Debbie's husband, Howie Whitlock, was at a co-worker's bachelor party on the night of the murder. He was out very late, and when he arrived home at 5:45 in the morning, he got the shock of his life. He discovered his wife, lifeless, in the hallway outside of their bedroom. Her throat had been slit, but their little daughter was unharmed. Miraculously, CJ had slept through the night. Debbie's friends and family were devastated. Her mother was so overcome with grief that she could barely function. When she learned that detectives had no viable suspects, she was outraged. She knew that her son-in-law was a suspect because spouses are usually the first to be scrutinized in homicide investigations. There was a moment when Jock, too, wondered if Howie could be guilty, but despite the fact their marriage had been troubled, Jock realized that Howie did not kill Debbie. He was a gentleman, and Jock defended him, and she was bothered by the gossip. When the neighbors were interviewed by reporters from the local newspaper, one was quoted that she hoped the murder was a result of a domestic dispute rather than a random occurrence. She would be safer, said the neighbor, if there were no random killer stalking the streets. As it turned out, of course, the culprit was a random killer, and the neighbor who had made the thoughtless remark could have been a victim just as easily as Debbie. But it was 9 long years before Scott Fizzle was caught. Throughout that time, Jacques worked tirelessly to get justice for his daughter. In her campaign to keep Debbie's memory alive, she plastered posters and flyers all over the city. She placed Debbie's picture on pizza boxes and grocery carts. And she also appeared on dozens of television programs to tell Debbie's story. Her efforts finally paid off when a witness saw one of Jacques' billboards and came forward in 1997. He had been a casual acquaintance of Scott's. On the night of the murder, Scott had visited and confessed that he had just killed a woman. Thanks to this informant's tip, Fizzle was arrested and the DNA evidence from the crime scene proved that he was indeed the killer. He pled guilty in 1999 and was sentenced to 31 years to life in prison. Jacques McDonald's quest for justice did not end with the conviction of Debbie's killer. She was passionate about justice for all victims and launched Victim's Voice, which was a 30-minute TV program that addressed the concerns of victims and their families. In one segment, with prior permission, she visited the crime scene where her daughter had drawn her last breath. The house's new owners were stunned to learn of the murder, but graciously allowed the video cameras inside. Jacques swallowed hard and followed the woman to the room that had once been Debbie's. The homeowner was astonished to realize that her grandson's special friend Debbie was not imaginary after all. She was a ghost. While only the little boy had actually seen the spirit, others had witnessed the door to Debbie's room opening and closing on its own. The new lady of the house told Jacques that she had been startled to see the rocking chair suddenly begin to rock. It happened when no one was in the chair, and no one was near enough to touch it. As the chair swayed, her grandson had pointed at it and announced, "Debbie's in the chair." Stranger still was to visit the grocery store. When his grandmother lifted up to put him in the shopping cart, the preschooler had taken one look at the face printed on the seat and screamed, "No, I don't want to sit on Debbie." The child could not be read, but he pointed to the photograph of the smiling young woman. It was a picture of Debbie on one of the notices that Jacques had placed on the cart seats. At the time, however, the grandmother had no idea who Debbie was or that anyone had been murdered in her home. After Jacques McDonald's visit, everything was chillingly clear. Jacques was not surprised to hear that the little boy had interacted with Debbie's ghost. The grieving mother believed with all of her heart that her daughter's spirit was still around because Debbie loved children. It was just like her to befriend a little boy. Paranormal investigators have long noted that earthbound spirits seem to be intrigued by people who remind them of those who they knew in life. In Debbie Whitlock's case, she was devoted to her young daughter. Debbie's sudden and violent death may have been a shock to her soul that she didn't realize she was dead. Possibly she was searching for her daughter, and when she couldn't find her in their home, she gravitated towards the new homeowner's grandchild, who was about the age of CJ when Debbie last saw her. There is an update on this story. While living in Merced, California, Jacques McDonald hosted Victim's Voice on TV and radio for 18 years and placed a special emphasis on unsolved homicides. She was a recipient of the Justice Department's National Crime Victim Service Award in 2007. However, her health declined in recent years and she died at age 86 in Grants Pass, Oregon on March 11, 2020. And stressed by the accusations against him, Howie Whitlock's life took a downward spiral and he died in 2001. His daughter, Debbie's stepdaughter, author Angela Dove, wrote a book about the murder and the toll it took on their family. It's called No Room for Doubt. Scott Fizell is currently still incarcerated at the Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California. In July 2020, he was denied parole after a psychologist determined that he still posed a high risk for violence. Good riddance. I hope he dies in there. Hollywood screenwriters seem to relish frightening viewers with their fictitious films of horror story hauntings, but in reality, most encounters involve benign spirits. Just as the child in the previous story befriended the ghost of Debbie Whitlock, the little girl in the next story has a very special bond with a friendly ghost that only she can see. When Cecilia Muirling was a little girl, she loved to visit her grandparents' farm on Guem's Island. The small secluded island is lesser known than the other popular tourist destinations, the San Juan Islands that are scattered across Puget Sound like irregular puddles of pancake batter on the grill. Guem's Island is just north across the channel from Anacortes, Washington, and was first settled by Cecilia's great-grandfather. My grandparents lived in a one-story house painted white. It sat back some distance from the road, and it was about a half mile up the hill from the ferry, said Cecilia, who today is a mother of a grown son. The Washington Cat Shelter volunteer can close her eyes and still see Dolly and Bonnie. her grandfather's sturdy white plow horses. He had chickens too, and it was my job to watch for hawks and tell him right away when I saw one. The picturesque farm, surrounded by pastures and cornfields, had been in the family for generations. In fact, Cecilia's mother had been born in the house. Dozens of cousins and aunts and uncles had also grown up on the island. Her grandparents, Bob and Mary Merchant, knew everybody who lived there. I called my grandmother Selah. She was short and plump, with curly dark hair. She loved her flower garden, and when I stayed there, we would get up early with the chickens. And with our pajamas still on, we'd go out to see what her girls were doing, she said, describing how they would admire the daffodils, the roses, and the pansies as the sun peeked over the horizon. Cecilia remembers the swing on the old crabapple tree and how her grandmother took the time from cooking to push her on it. She would stir a pot, then run out and give me a push, then run back in and stir some more. We were very close, and we could talk about anything. Yet there was a time when one topic was off limits. Cecilia was 4 years old when she found herself unwilling to speak to anybody about someone very special to her. One bright spring day, Cecilia told her grandmother that she was going out to play. She stepped outside into the fresh, salty air, and as she skipped towards the field, she was met by a girl. She was not familiar to me, Cecilia said. Yet it was like she was waiting for me. The little girls looked into each other's smiling eyes and clasped hands. It was an instant, blissful bond. I was so happy to see her, and she was just as happy to see me. We ran in the field, holding hands and giggling. The child was about Cecilia's size and clad in a pair of blue overalls. Her blonde curls bounced, shining in the sunshine as they frolicked. We never talked, said Cecilia. We never said a word. The girls headed towards the barn and were playing behind it when Cecilia heard her grandmother calling. Grandma Selah's voice was strained with worry. Cecilia knew that her grandmother liked to keep an eye on her. So, she let go of her little friend's hand and stepped out from behind the barn. I waved to my grandmother to let her know where I was, she said. She turned back to her friend, but the girl with the curly hair was gone. When Grandma Selah approached to see what her grandchild was up to, Cecilia excitedly told her that she had been playing with her new friend. Her grandmother glanced around. I would like to know who you were talking about, she said. Cecilia grabbed Grandma Selah's hand and pulled her along, saying, Come on and meet her. She knew her friend could not have gone far, but the child had vanished as suddenly as she had appeared. They gazed about, their eyes searching the pastures and fields stretched out before them. The corn hadn't started to grow again, and there wasn't anywhere to hide. So, where was she? I want to play with her, Cecilia insisted. Well, I wish I knew who you were talking about, said Grandma Selah, and shook her head. I can't imagine who she could be. The nearest neighbors lived far down the road. Grandma Selah knew everyone on the island and had never seen a child like the one Cecilia described. Yet at age 4, Cecilia could not grasp the enormity of the mystery. She knew only that her friend had brought her joy, and she could not wait to see her again. She searched Grandma's barn and yard, peeking behind the apple trees. She circled the house, desperately hoping that the giggling girl would pop out from a hiding place, but she never saw her again. Cecilia said sadly that she was overwhelmingly disappointed that she could not find her. Later, when she overheard her grandmother telling her mother about the mystery girl, Cecilia felt an odd stinging in her belly. Her grandmother made it sound as if something was wrong. To me, it had been the most natural thing in the world, she confided, but my grandmother made such a big issue of it that I decided to never talk about it again. She still missed her friend, but she kept it to herself. Years later, when her grandmother mentioned the puzzling visit from the little girl, Cecilia told her that she still remembered it. Grandma Selah's eyes narrowed as she pondered the possibilities. I don't know who she could have been, she said, unless she was some kind of an angel. It was then that Cecilia began to wonder. Perhaps the little girl had not been of this world. It was hard to imagine. Her hand had been warm and solid when she held it in her own. Where had the girl come from? How could she have appeared so quickly and then disappeared again? Why didn't they see her running away across the fields? Essentially, where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cotton-Eyed Joe. If she was a spirit child, perhaps she was a relative. Cecilia's great-grandmother had given birth to 17 children on the island, and not all had survived childhood. It seems that whoever she was, the gleeful child was indeed from another place. She had not arrived on the island by ferry boat as Cecilia had, but had journeyed there from an unknown world in a mysterious fashion. Angel or ghost, Cecilia will never forget her. The little girl brought me such a feeling of pure joy and bliss, said Cecilia. I've never felt that happy since, ever. I wonder if I will ever see her again. So when it comes to ghost encounters, the younger the child, the more accepting they are, it seems. Older kids tend to be spooked when they see apparitions, probably because they've internalized our culture's fearful attitude about the paranormal. Reactions are varied, and sometimes kids are afraid, simply because they sense the fear that the spirit felt in their last moments alive. Sometimes kids aren't really frightened, but simply startled because the encounters take them by surprise. Who knows? And who am I to say? As we conclude another gripping episode, I want to remind each and every one of you to keep an eye on the horizon throughout the day because we have more content and exciting giveaways coming your way. The world of the supernatural and the uncanny is full of mysteries, and we're dedicated to exploring every captivating corner of it, so don't miss out on what's to come. Thank you for joining us on this enthralling journey, and may your curiosity for the eerie and the unexplained never waver. Stay tuned for more captivating narratives on the Anthology of Horror podcast. I'll talk to you soon, but until then, stay spooky.
But I'd been forgotten, I'd been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? But I'd been forgotten, I'd been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe?
did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe?